Richard Havers, welcome back to Jazz FM. When we last spoke, you had produced a fantastic book about the Verve label last year, in fact.
Yeah.
And there was some associate stuff going on at London Jazz Festival. And you told me about your Blue Note book, and here it is, Uncompromising Expression. And it is a magnificent piece of work. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. It's I look at it and can't quite believe I did it. It's because it's something, you know, something that you're passionate about, and music that you're passionate about, and you get the opportunity to do something like this, and you know, when you talk about it before you do it, and then it happens.
The difference between Verve and Blue Note, though, is distinctive, isn't it? There's something about the Blue Note record label that encapsulates a magical story that begins with the sort of American dream. It's all about the aesthetic. It's all about the engineering. It just ticks every single box. How did you begin to set out to write this book, and where did you start with it?
Well, it was actually very easy, but shortly after I saw you last year, I went to New York and met with Don Woz, who's the president of Blue Note, and we just got a copy of the Verve book. I mean, took it out there to him, and we had a meeting and with him and Hank Forsyth. Hank is the kind of the MD of Blue Note, and we were sitting there, and Don is looking at the book and he's turning the pages and he's muttering, and Tristan Delancey from Thames and Hudson, the publisher, and I sort of having a conversation with Hank, but hearing Don muttering off to one side. And I'm thinking, what the heck is going on here? And eventually, Don closes the book. He said, man, we've got a problem. This book is so good, but Blue Note's got to be better. So that was the challenge. Make a better book. I was very pleased with the Verve book. I still am very pleased with the Verve book. But it was a very different kind of book about a very different kind of label. But the first challenge was, we have to do something different. Now, it's one thing that makes Blue Note easier is, from a visuals point of view, it's got that common aesthetic that runs through because of Reed Miles. But there's been books about Blue Note covers, so just another book with lots of covers in wouldn't be the answer, although there's plenty of cover shots that would be. But so that was the tricky part. But this whole story of Blue Note, with Alfred Lion arriving in America in the late 30s and starting a record label, I think more by happenstance than by design, is just such a brilliant story. This idea of a Jewish German escaping Nazi Germany, going to America, and through his enthusiasm and love for jazz, starts a record label. And I think that creates a story. I mean, how on earth does somebody do that? You don't just get up in the morning and go, I think I'll start a record label, unless you're in Hollywood. And I think that's what was so brilliant about what Lion's vision. And the vision, too, with him and Max Margulis, about they wanted things to look right. That Bauhaus influence from Germany. Beautiful, clean typography. Even the early press releases looked the coolest thing around. So I think that started to drive the story, because it's to me, always music is a reflection of cultural history. Music both creates cultural history and reflects what's going on. So putting those two things together creates a story. It's not a book of jazz criticism about which is the best Blue Note album, or from a musical standpoint, it's a bigger story than that.
Yeah, I think in an emerging nation, which America still was very much in the early to mid 20th century, this label has intertwined itself with American history beyond just being a place where musicians were signed to make albums, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think you've just nailed it. I wish I'd have said it. It's much more succinct than what I'd said. But you're right. It is. They just the idea of taking music and packaging it. And I use that word loosely, because they didn't set out to package it in a certain way, but presenting their music in the most thoughtful way possible, hence Uncompromising Expression and the whole idea of this this manifesto that they came up with in 1939, and it's driven the company throughout its entire history and still does with Don. But it's certainly, you know, there are people, I think, possibly, who've forgotten that when Blue Note started, it wasn't on the cutting edge of jazz. I mean, it was, you know, without Sidney Bechet doing a very, very beautiful but standard version of Summertime, there would be no Blue Note. Simple as that. That record kept the company afloat and enabled it to move to the next base, which was still only Art Hodes and New Orleans and other similar kind of music. It wasn't until Thelonious Monk came along in 1947 that there was a hint of anything. Wow, this is out there.
German Immigrant comes to America, starts label 1939. It's still going as an imprint, of course, so we're talking 75 years of Blue Note Records. Interestingly, New York plays a very important part geographically in the development of the music. It's a very super cool sound that's coming out of an urban centre, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, to me, whenever I'm in New York, I play Blue Note, because it is the soundtrack to New York City. I mean, wherever you go, wherever you are in the city, there's Blue Note music that just makes you, it just oozes New York. And that sophistication, that level, you're absolutely right, Chris. The sophistication of it is complete. And coming along at that period, you know, just before the war, Second World War, and then the Second World War takes place, and 1947, as I was saying earlier about Thelonious Monk, they were perfectly placed to take the label to that next level. And it did reflect that post-war optimism going. And I mean, it clearly wasn't thought through in that. Nobody thought, I'm making the soundtrack to post-war optimism. But it did somehow. It absorbed all of that was going on around it. And out of it came this, I mean, just this coolest music. I mean, it's just amazing, isn't it?
Thumbing through the pages, it goes well beyond, as you say, you were aware of books of Blue Note covers. Of course, it starts, I guess, like any Blue Note fan would expect, with a few pages of iconic Blue Note covers and montages and stuff. But well beyond that, you've got documents such as Alfred Lion's immigration arrival certificate.
Yeah.
Where did you source stuff like this?
That's down to the skill of Thames and Hudson. I mean, they were on the case right from the start, looking for those sort of interesting... We got in touch by happenstance with Max Margulis's great niece, who had, quote unquote, a box of his stuff. And that box of stuff had those completely unseen press releases. Nobody has seen that stuff since then. She also had a copy of the original press release with the original manifesto on it, which is the first paragraph, which is actually slightly different to the ones that have been printed ever since. It's somebody transcribed it incorrectly. So it's wonderful to go back to source. So that's there. But as important, obviously, with anything Blue Note, the photographs, Francis Wolff's photography, Michael Cascuna, who worked for Blue Note from the early 70s all the way through the lean years, and worked with Bruce Lundvall when Blue Note came back. He owns now the Francis Wolff Photographic Archive. He saw the Verve book and he said to us, you can have any picture you want from Francis's. And so we've got many things that have never been seen before, because people think they may have seen all the photographs, but what was only certain things have been allowed out. We've got the contact sheets of, you know, the 12 shots of Jimmy Smith back at the Chicken Shack, you know, or that sort of thing is wonderful, where you can see the one that became the album cover with the Chinagraph pencil marks on it.
I love that. I saw the Inventions and Dimensions Herbie Hancock contact sheet, where he's straddled a yellow line down the middle of a street in New York. But there are all these other shots that could have become the album cover. And it's a fascinating insight into how they narrowed down, even scribbling on the photos, you know, the potential crop. Incredible stuff. Of all the, a lot of artists on Blue Note Records have passed on now, and you were fortunate enough to get that archive. But is there another from those that survive today that may have recorded for Blue Note Records, another one or two golden moments of where you made a discovery?
Not, to be honest, no. One of the sad things, I think, about record labels is... it's not a sad thing, it's a fact of life. Record labels were in the now. They were living in the now, they were getting a record out, boom, record out, next week, another record out, another two records out. So people don't tend to hang on to things. It's amazing how much of this stuff has been junked over the years. You know, people have made a living practically out of going into skips in certain places and pulling out stuff that record companies have thrown away. So Blue Note was no different. They had no conscious thought of saving their archive, and nor, I think, the artists who make the records either. I don't know. I mean, this is a lame kind of way of putting it, but you know, I've written a number of books. They're done. I've written it's done. I'm not saying I'm not proud of it. I'm not saying, but I wouldn't keep. You know, I wish I had kept some of the things because I've moved on to the next project. And I think, you know, that to me, that's what characterizes Blue Note music. I mean, it's guys looking for the next boundary. It's crossing into the next dimension of their musical journey.
Do you have a personal collection of a large collection of Blue Note records yourself?
No, I'm not a record collector.
Oh.
I've never been a record. I collected records up until about 20 years ago. I had about 10,000 albums, LPs, and my wife-to-be, who is now my wife, who I love dearly, was kind of like, either they go or you go.
Oh,
because
no.
We're... And, you know, it wasn't that hard, because to me, I can get the music. I'm not a... I collect ephemera. I have a collection of melody makers going back to the 1920s. I've got NMEs going right back to the start. I love ephemera because I love that cultural history. The music, I can listen to it any time on my iPad or iPod or computer. The music's always there. And one of my close friends is Ian Rankin, the crime writer, who is a absolute vinyl junkie. And I take my vinyl copies, I've been given the vinyl Blue Note round to him. He's in heaven. And he sits there and plays them. And he says, don't you think this is better than... I said, it's better because you get up and turn them over.
That physical interaction sort of makes it better, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Let's talk about Blue Note from the cultural reference that is made to the, you know, the graphic design and the aesthetic of the label. All those great, great covers that came out. Tons of great imaginative covers with the duotone in many of them. They, beyond music, it turned it into an icon of graphic design, didn't it?
Yes.
And they still refer to some of those designs and mimic them today.
One of the really most interesting people I talked to when I was doing the book was Paul Bacon, who was the original Blue Note designer. He was there for those early years up until, you know, the early 50s, when 54, when Reed Miles came along. And if you look at Paul Bacon's designs, they are wonderful. The early Thelonious Monk albums are Paul's design. The Sidney Bechet albums with his art on them. When Reed Miles came along, he took it completely in a different direction. Nobody could have imagined where he was going to take that album design. And I think that's one of the reasons that makes Blue Note cool for people, I think. Before you even got the record out the sleeve, it looked really cool. And what's very interesting is he didn't like jazz. He was a classical music fan, and he was briefed. Alfred would say to him, well, this record's called such and such. It's kind of like this, and these are the players on it, and this is what it's going to be called. Design.
And off he went.
Which makes it even more clever.
Yeah.
As time went along, of course, he got more involved in the process, and he of course, took Francis Wolff's photography and used that in many of the album sleeves. Much apparently, to Michael Cascuna told me that Frank Wolff hated the fact that Reed cropped his photographs, because as far as he was concerned, he'd lined them up perfectly in the first place. And then later on, Reed started taking the photographs himself sometimes, and You're thinking of Horace Silver's Song for My Father. That's Reed's photograph of Horace's father. And Eric Dolphy's Out to Lunch with the funny clock on it. He spotted that in his lunch hour when he was going out, took the picture, and that became the...
Literally out to lunch.
Literally out to lunch. Isn't that brilliant?
Yeah.
I mean, that's that guy. But he was a designer previously for Esquire magazine and went on to design thousands and thousands of book jackets as well. So gifted man.
Throughout the book, you detail the minutiae of sessions for particular albums with full credits involved. How did you get to the bottom of, you know, the story of how each session unfolded? Is it literally just from the original sleeve notes? Or?
A bit of everything. I mean, again, without Michael Cascuna, this book wouldn't be what it is, I have to say. Michael, he has compiled the ultimate Blue Note discography. It's so large, it has to be on a CD. It's everything is there. And so you put that with the original sleeve notes and start... And things start to... It's like doing a jigsaw, you know, you start to get the... But the basic information came from Michael's discography, which is brilliant. But it was being able to look at that and think when somebody's first session was or... It fascinated me how most people came into Blue Note as an ensemble player to begin with and were part of somebody else's albums or did a few. Every now and again, somebody came along and just made an album off the bat. And you think, wonder what gave him the confidence to give them their gig straight off the bat like that. But he clearly had some moments where Horace Parlane was one where he fell in love with him. Absolutely. Fell in love with him and just thought it was marvellous. But that idea of people working together and sort of earning the right, maybe that's too strong a way of putting it, but almost, you know, earning their stripes.
Paying their dues.
Yeah. And of course, you know, the fact that with Blue Note, as opposed to Verve, you know, Norman Granz loved the jam session. So he put his guys in the studio, make a record. Elfrid was... You have 2 days rehearsal, then you make a record, which is one of the reasons why the music is more complex, that it's more worked through. It doesn't sound as boom.
As a catalogue, it's a very male-dominated record label, isn't it? Where are the women?
Yeah, not many. Jutta Hipp, I think, was the first one. She was German, and perhaps that's why she got the gig. But no, it's... I called one of the chapters, I think it was the 50s, It's a Man's World, because it is. It is a male label. And I mean, generally speaking, I mean, but there's not too many jazz instrumentalists that one can think of who are women. I mean, it would have to be singers. And for a long time, there weren't any voices on Blue Note Records. And it was only in the 60s, when Elfrid was still there, that they did a couple of sessions with singers. I think that was about making money. I think it was simply, do you know what? Ella's selling a lot of records. Maybe we could sell some records.
Why do you think they were averse to putting singers on the label?
I think it's a reflection of Elfrid's taste. I think he clearly didn't, you know, I've read some letters of his that Michael showed me where he would express, you know, that he didn't particularly like certain music, but he realised it was important. I'm not comparing myself with Elfrid, but I have the same feeling. I don't like everything that's on Blue Note. I openly say that I struggle with Andrew Hill. It doesn't... I don't get it. And then on the back of one of the Andrew's albums, he explains that his music is very mathematical and it's very precise and it's very... I'm no mathematician. That's what I can only put it down to, because it just doesn't float my boat.
Yeah.
But... Hey.
It's impossible to love all of it. I mean, I'm not a fan of the sort of more traditional early stuff. I'm very much a 50s, 60s, and yeah, definitely a fusion 70s guy, you know, where some would decry that. You know, there was a point where Blue Note changed very much in some people's eyes for the worst in say, 1970s, when they made a lot of fusion material. Is that a key moment in the record label in a negative way?
I'm with you. You see, I don't think it's a bad... clearly, Elfrid sold the label in 1967, stayed on for a little bit, left. Frank Wolf stayed around for a little bit and then passed away, sadly. It was owned at this point. I think it was still owned by Liberty at that point before Transamerica got involved. It became part of a big machine and it needed to make money. It wasn't run as a... I mean, I think the thing that Elfrid didn't like was he had to answer memos. People sent him memos. I can't imagine in the whole history of Blue Note anybody ever wrote a memo to anybody until he sold the company. So it was a different beast. So it just moved on, and music has to move on. I mean, jazz in the late 60s, rock was the new jazz. People, you go back to the Verve scenario. Frank Zappa signs to Verve. That was a very, very bold move. It didn't really work out, but it was a very bold move, and you can see why they did it, because the, you know, the so-called Woodstock generation comes along, and you know, Hendrix was Charlie Parker. People were looking for a new way to express themselves. Where, and plus that was in that period of where Black American jazz artists were rediscovering their connections and rediscovering their roots. And even it was around the same time, you know, Isaac Hayes goes and does Wattstacks in Africa, and there was that. It was a changing time, wasn't it? It was very much a reflection of what was going on culturally,
yeah.
And the music reflected that. And we got, you know, Donald Byrd, Bring It On, Blackbird. I love that album. I absolutely love it. Bobby Humphries, I'm the same about. And I've had arguments with members of the Jazz Police who say that nobody can listen to that because they would be committing some sort of heinous crime. But that's brought so many people into the jazz tent. It's brought people into Blue Note because they've been sampled. Lou Donaldson's Ode to Billy Joe, I think, has been sampled over 900 times. Maybe not everybody knows that, but when somebody finds that out, they go, maybe I'd like to listen to that. And they start their journey, because I certainly wouldn't start my journey with Andrew Hill. Yeah, it's, somebody said to me recently about, I was talking about putting together, you know, 20 albums that you would want to give to somebody to get them interested in jazz. I got absolutely beaten up by the fact that I didn't say Love Supreme. Somebody else said to me afterwards, well, Love Supreme's a destination, it's not a starting point. I love that. I love it. And I've nicked it and used it several times since.
I'm learning here. This is great. Do you think we need to defeat the Jazz Police in order to keep this music alive and healthy?
I think they defeat themselves every day. I think they defeat themselves by the idea that in my head, I see the Jazz Police as Gollum. And that's the way they operate. You know, it is mine, precious. You know, to me, the only reason to write a book like this is to bring people into jazz. If people pick this book up and go, God, this looks pretty cool. I wonder what this sounds like. If I encourage one person to go out and listen to Blue Note albums, I've done my job. I'd like to encourage more than one, but that's all you can hope for. And I don't want to be stuffy about it. I'm not a musician, so I can't write as a musician would write about music. I write if it touches me, and I'm fascinated by the cultural history. I know what I like, and I like what I know. And you know, that's to me is so. As I say, Jazz Police, I think they've defeated themselves some time ago.
I love the fact that Don Was still uses the original written manifesto. He's got it in a drawer in his office somewhere and takes a look at it every now and again just to make sure he's on point. And going forward for Blue Note 76 and onwards, I mean, it's quite exciting times. We've got, obviously, Gregory Porter on the label already. Van Morrison's making a bit of an appearance. We've got Chris Dave, exciting drummer, who's reinventing the idea of drumming, coming up. And even the greats like Wayne Shorter coming back. And Kenny Burrell on the imprint again with his reemergence. Next year, it's quite exciting times, isn't it, going forward? It's very strong.
I love it. Bobby Hutcherson's just made an album. And at the London Jazz Fest this year with Robert Glasper and Jason Moran and their all-star band, it's going to be fantastic. I mean, there cannot be another record label that has got such a diverse roster. And, you know, Roseanne Cash's album last year. It's not a jazz album. I wouldn't try and pretend it isn't, but it's a great album. And the fact that Blue Note's given it, if that doesn't win a Grammy this year, I will be stunned. I mean, it's one of the most wonderful listening experiences. You know, it gets into that Americana, that rootsy kind of thing. And at the end of it all, what is jazz if it's not Americana? It's possibly the ultimate piece of Americana.
We'll leave it there. Richard Havis, magnificent book, and thank you again for coming in to Jazz FM.
Thanks for having me, Chris. Always a pleasure.